partner Eugene, and we'll be presenting our senior project. And we did this work in the Cooper Union from fall 2009 to the spring of 2010. And we have an additional group member who's not present today, Josh. So I'll just start by showing you a picture of one of our setups. So you see we have a camera over there. This is what we refer to as the field of view. So for our system, we concentrated only on static hand gestures, and by that I mean that there was no moving in the hand gesture, so that makes the recognition much easier, or relatively easier, I should say. And then we have it connected to a laptop PC. We also had an embedded device that we ran the system on, and I'll talk more about that later. So there's three stages to our hand gesture recognition system. The first stage is detection. So once you place the hand in the field of view, you want to be able to identify that the object there is actually a hand. And the way we did that is using what's known as Riolo-Jones, and that's a standard algorithm or set of methods that are used in object recognition to find the object. And we did that through OpenCV, and we performed hard training there. The second part of our system was segmentation. And by that we mean that we wanted to distinguish all the pixels of the background from the pixels of the hand. So basically, the output of the segmentation stage is a black and white image. So for example, in our case, we had the hand being white and the background was black. And the recognition stage, that was sort of where we identified the gesture and we matched it to what the intended meaning of the gesture was. So there's several issues with detection of the hand. The first of these is obviously shape variance, so different people have sort of different hands. It's also the size of the hand, and you know, if you have a little kid, that's a much different scale than a full-grown human being. And also lighting, which is very important because different lighting produces different images, and it changes the values of the image. So that was very important. And there's three characteristics that we looked at. So the first of these was accuracy. So we wanted the hand to be accurately identified as opposed to another object in the field of view. So if you have, like, I don't know, a cell phone or something in there, you don't want that to be recognized as a hand. Speed. If we wanted to do this in real time, we want it to be as fast as possible. And the third one is robustness, so that's you're dealing with lightning. And the reason for that is that we want to be able to move the system around. Oh, so I forgot to mention something in the beginning about what George was saying, that this is definitely a proof of concept project type. It's not a production environment, so I should have said that as a warning in the beginning. So take everything from here on out, I guess, in that sense. Now Eugene's going to talk about the sort of the databases we use for detection.
So for detection, we use the Riolo-Jones OpenCV, which is an independent OpenCV.
Can you speak a little louder? Maybe you want to use the mic? Switch on the mic. Sorry.
This guy knows this problem. Hello. Alright, this is our, I'm going to talk about our detector that we use to isolate the hand from the frame.
Sorry.
Rest it on your chin and your hand.
Alright.
It works.
A lot of the work we did with the detection stage involved creating a database at the places that the to train the classifier for, which and the training algorithm came from OpenCV, which is the library we used. So we used 5,000 images of just hands and different gestures, and we can't clock it, there was some from the internet, some we took videos of. And then we also had 3,000 negative images, which were just random objects that did not have hands, and those at the, which was supposed to be like the background. And our system in the end had 8 gestures that it was recognizing, and some of these were palm up and some palm down gestures from American Sign Language. So a little bit more detail about the how the OpenCV Viola Jones rapid object detection works. So this is a very popular method used in face facial recognition. So that's why we have to create our own databases, because there aren't really any databases available for hand recognition. You can see here, this is just one frame, and you can see how particularly for that gesture, we generally find it very well, and it has a rectangle around, square around my hand. And so the way this method works is that it applies a scanning, quick scanning window to each continuous feature or part of the image. Then it tries to figure out whether there's a hand in that part of the image, and it does that at various resolutions of the image. And it uses these features to decide whether there's a hand or not there, and these features are shown here, and they're calculated by summing the white area and subtracting it from the black area. The way it tends to work is by finding the most important of these features and using them to remove a lot of the potential windows that will definitely not have a hand moving in. So that's a little bit about how that works. Once this process is finished, that the rest of the images crop and just pass the hand to the next stage, which is the segmentation. So that attempts to find the just which pixels in the actual image are skin pixels and which are not. And that's done largely using color thresholding. So a simple example of that is if you have everything is RGB, you just set thresholds for which red, green, and blue values are skin pixels. We actually found in research and like a lot of experimentation that using other color spaces made it much more invariant. So we used a hue saturation value color space, and we would have a threshold set. And where we got the thresholds from, there would be a program that the user could use before the system that would basically places a hand in a certain area, it would take a snapshot and calculate some statistics on it, and just take where 95% of the skin pixels are, it would set thresholds there, and those are the thresholds that we would use. So that made it easier to calibrate for different environments. That was the segmentation stage.
So what do we mean by recognition? So basically we have an input image from the detection stage, from the segmentation stage, and you have a system alphabet, which is all the gesture that your system is capable of recognizing. So what you want to do is basically match the input image to one of the gestures that you have, and the output of that stage, of the recognition stage, is basically your answer. You know, if I do this, is it the American Sign Language A, or is it not? Or is it B or something else? So one method of doing recognition is through template matching. And basically what this means is that you do a pixel by pixel comparison for each image. So the way you do this is by defining a distance function, and a simple distance function is just subtracting the pixel values and taking like an absolute value. The image that is closest is the match. So you have to match to every pixel. You have to match this image to every image in the database. So you're comparing across all gestures. And so the computational complexity of this is big O of k times n times n. So k is the number of training images per gesture, m gestures, and n pixels per image. So, for example, as I'll say later, we were using something like 80 training images for, let's say, 8 gestures, and we were using 220 by 240 images. You can see that this is a large amount of computations to do in order to recognize a single gesture. So one method that looks into resolving this issue is what's known as the boosting algorithm, and this is something that we found and implemented. So basically what you do is you set certain thresholds and you eliminate images in the training set which are very similar to each other, and the output of that is, we'll call it K-prime images, which are now your new training set. Once you have these K-prime images, which are referred to as coherence map, you basically just take a mean of those M-prime images. And once you do that, you have a single image, which is basically your training data for that gesture. And once you have that, you look across all the gestures, and you look for the pixels that distinguish the gestures from each other. So basically, you're starting with a set of pixels, which is less than or equal to the total number of pixels in the image, and you're limiting the pixels down, trying to distinguish as many of the gestures as you can. So basically, what this means is that you have a reduced computational complexity of big O of 1 times n times n prime, and that's a significant improvement. However, one of the problems with this method is that it's not invariant to scale rotation and translation, which is probably the biggest set of problems for this system. So originally, we intended to deal with these problems in the detection stage. However, we were not able to do so. So we had to deal with these problems in the recognition stage. So what you see here is the binarized image. And over here, the black and white pixels are the set of M prime pixels that were chosen across the set of all of our gestures, which were used to classify the image. So what this means, though, is that the hand image had a very specific orientation and location, and also the scale was predefined. So this method is, it would be really good in a situation where you deal with these three invariances beforehand. So what we ended up doing is we just tested this in MATLAB, but we never actually used it in the later stages of the system. So another method of doing recognition is based on the contour of the hand. So basically, again, we have a binarized image, and we use contour extraction techniques, and basically we get a set of complex points which determine in the 2D image the location of the contour. So this set of points defines your image. And now Yuji will talk about two methods of doing recognition through contours.
So we tried two different methods of these contours, and the first one was called the Fourier descriptor. So what this this work is, you take a contour and represent it as a sequence of complex points, and you take the Fourier transform. And then there's papers and stuff that show how you can achieve invariant features that are invariant to translation. So you remove the first component, makes the features invariant to translation, position of the hand. And if you normalize everything by the second component, it makes it invariant to the scale. And finally, the most important part of this method was that if you take the magnitude, it made it invariant to rotations in the contour. So once these features were calculated, they were compared to template, the training sort of data using different distance functions that we experimented with. And we came with this method. We found that only using the first eight FFT components was enough to get most of the accuracy being improved, basically, after that. But we had a lot of problems with this method. It wasn't always working well because of the contour finding algorithms. They didn't guarantee the order of the contour would be correct. So we tried another method where this wasn't an issue. And that was the key moments. So key moments an image moment is basically like a way to sum up the pixels and their position to the center. And so this is a key moment is a set of so by combining these image moments in certain special ways that this guy Hugh showed, you can achieve invariant features, create invariant features that are invariant to all these properties. And so we use these we calculate them and use them also. We tried various distance functions and we got significantly better accuracy with this recognition method. So this is what we chose in the end.
So I'm going to just talk a little bit about sort of our testing and our results. So the 80 training images, so we initially had a database of 46 gestures, and this was a preset database of what I'm going to refer to as an ideal testing set. So it was sort of what I was talking about before with the boosting method. They had a very well segmented and also oriented set of training images. So basically, I split that set of images into 80 training images and 19 testing images for each of the 46 gestures. And using this boosting method, I was able to recognize 95% of these 19 testing images. So that's a really good result if you can guarantee, like I said, that your gestures or your images are well segmented and oriented and scaled. Here are the results for the other two methods. So the 40 descriptors method, that had an 87% accuracy on this ideal testing set. However, on the real testing set we generated ourselves, we only got 16%. And the reason why this happened is because, as Eugene said, once we had the contour, it wasn't guaranteed that it was properly ordered in the way that we traced out the shape of the hand. And there was no easy or obvious way for us to do this. So due to time constraints, we sort of just stuck with these results. The second method, the few moments, we had 83% recognition rate on the ideal testing set and 63% recognition rate on the testing set. So what this meant is that basically we took a bunch of images of hands in our field of view and we ran it through our segmentation stage, and we then tested the accuracy. So this is what we used in the final prototype. It was the humongous. So obviously this system is like it's very computationally intensive. So one thing that we envision is that you have it running on some kind of external device which would be communicating to the device that's actually using the hand gestures as input. So basically, we decided to use the gum sticks. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. Basically, the actual gum stick is only a portion of this. This is the board, and it's literally like the size of a gum stick that is, so does the name. So what it has is a 600 megahertz processor and a TI DSP processor as well. And also the cool thing about it is that it came with Linux, and we also ran Linux on it. So basically we're doing our development in Linux. And it was convenient for us that we could basically move our code and get it working on this device. The other thing that was cool about the expansion board was that It had USB support, which we need for the camera, obviously. And it also had HDMI, so we could even take a look on what was going on real time at the output. So we were successfully able to implement it. There were some issues with the drivers for the camera, but we sort of got through them. We had it working again. So these are some stats about the frame rate that we're able to achieve. So on a 2.2 gigahertz Intel Core 2 Duo, it ran at 26 frames per second with the detector turned on. And I would say probably the detector was the most computationally intensive part of our system. And without the detector, basically we were running it real time. So we'll show a video of that. On the gun stick, with the detector, it only achieves 3 frames per second. So one thing that we initially wanted to do is basically have a program which would also take advantage of the DSP processor, which would be sort of optimized for these types of operations with images. So it would be really good at computing Fourier transforms and also dealing with vectors. However, it has its own sort of a subset of special C, and we didn't really get around to it. Without the detector, we were able to achieve 15 frames per second, and I'll show you what I mean by that right now. So before we take any questions, I'll just show up. So just quickly, sort of what you're seeing over here. Okay. So what you see here is, I don't know if everybody in the back can see it, sort of, this is the detection stage, so this is the input to the detection stage. And once the detector runs through this stage, basically, this is the output of the detection stage, which is a cropped image of the hand. And once this is done, we have the segmentation stage output the binarized image over there on the top. And once that stage had its output, this is sort of, this was running interactively in a command prompt in a shell. And basically, you could see the distances to each of the gestures in our system, and it would also tell you the output. So in this case, it correctly recognized the output. So we had the gesture A input and the output of the recognizer of the system is A. So I'll just play this for a little bit. So this is the gesture B. I recognized that correctly. But it's not always detecting it, as you can see.
Yeah, we had a lot of problems detecting the palm or gestures. But it, yeah, as you can see, I'm trying to get a reply.
So this is the first demo, and then okay, so this is without the detection stage. So basically, this is just we're running it live to the segmentation stage. So as you can see, this is the output of the segmentation stage. It is the black and white image representing the hand. And over here again, we have the output. So I'll just run this. So this is the gesture B. So this is the gesture B, which it correctly recognizes. This is the American Sign Language gesture for B, I believe, and his gesture is not correctly recognized, so I worked for some... this is another predefined gesture that we have, so this is basically out of another database, and this gesture was intended sort of to be like a right click, but you can define it to be anything in your system. Do you guys have any questions or comments? I don't know. Yeah, sure.
What was your most interesting or satisfying thing that you learned throughout this process? Because I know once you get a breakthrough in something that you really worked on, it can be really satisfying, or finally that's over.
I think the most satisfying thing was when we were able to get actually a recognition method that worked correctly. So that 63% that you see there, we were pretty excited about that because that meant that we could sort of do this demo and the whole project wouldn't be sort of complete failure. So that was probably the coolest thing. And then I guess there's a lot of issues that you don't envision when you're sort of doing this type of research. So it definitely always takes longer than you expected, I'd say. And you're never really satisfied with the thing. So it's sort of a different mentality than a company or a production environment.
No, it's the same.
I was a little confused. I'm not sure what I maybe I missed in the beginning, but why does the frame rate matter? I mean, if you're taking a static image, if you're trying to do hand recognition, why worry about frame rates if you just want static
images? We're taking a static image and we're interpreting that as a gesture. We want to be able to do this continuously.
Oh, sorry, gesture as an action, inaction.
Yeah, so you do the gesture, you do this gesture, or for example, this gesture, and then you switch right away, like within a few seconds or whatever, less than a few seconds, you'd switch it to a different gesture. So our intention is basically you'd be able to use this to communicate with an interface or a computer.
So a dynamic living breathing system as opposed to...
Yeah, so basically you'd be able, for example, you'd be able to navigate a buoy or something with this. So
right.
That's one. So another thing that could be done here is you could also have tracking of the hand. So if you're tracking the hand, you could basically use it as a mouse and a keyboard, and that's one of the things that we saw in the research that people had tried to do is basically track the hand across the field of view where you have the camera set up, and then as you're changing gestures, you do a right click, left click, whatever. So yeah, there was a question in the back.
What's the level of complexity? How complex is this system that you're going to build? Is this be able to be extended to non-linear gestures? For example, the New Jersey State Bird, for example?
Yes, we've had the same question actually.
You can't answer this.
Yes. For ASL, say, suppose a gesture, I don't know anything about ASL, suppose it were to consist of two static things, right? So your table static things. Then you have vibrant static things. So what does that distribution look like? In other words, maybe you could do better if you do gestures and it's a mutual information
thing. Do you mean if you have a dynamic gesture, which consists of...
Well, I'm using the usual, I mean, there's obviously a lot of people trying things, but human beings look at the pictures and say, well, this is something of some type. That's a static thing. And you have a second one, and the gesture would consist of the first one followed by the second one, approximately. Depending on ASL, its statistics, how you make up
Oh, like hand gestures?
Are you meaning tool thing? Oh, okay. You mean so you like let's say you're using it to spell out words.
Right.
That's not something that we looked at, but I mean I'd say just off the top of my head, obviously there's a lot of like studies on that between the probability. Yeah, that's definitely that's a cool idea.
I wondered if you have.
Are you talking about like T9 or something? Or just like fixes what you're writing? Telling me? Like it tries to figure out what you're mean by the
part. No, I think he's trying to say I think he's trying to say you can use the gesture before to determine sort of to have a better idea of what the gesture
after.
Yeah,
so start seeing it as a process instead of just
getting but that means that you're sort of dealing with one certain application. So if you were using just ASL to spell out words to the device, then you could do something like this where you actually include probabilities in terms of the letters of the alphabet corresponding to words.
The next one given what you've seen so far.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that's definitely
based on the characteristics of the hand and the type of gestures that every individual does in their own way. Or this is where I'm confused. Or in the sense that like they use the preposition, so next is a noun.
So I think we're
grammar different in ASL.
Yeah. No, I actually know the alphabet. I know the tongue, but not that I would, but.
What about monkeys?
I'm sorry. Moving along. Sign language. Some people say they learned it, and some people say they didn't. That was before you were born.
I'm not sure about
it. That's fine. You can bring a monkey.
I think you had a question.
Was there anything surprising in your common accuracy sensitive to? I sort of work better on a.
Definitely the big thing was sort of lighting. So we mentioned it in the beginning that it's one of the ideal things that we want the system to be. An ideal system would be invariant to it. But what we found out is that even moving from one room to another, the lighting conditions change significantly. Basically the value that the camera would output to the images would vary, and that could cause problems. For example, even when you're doing when you're doing the segmentation stage, basically that would move around the pixel values and it would change the threshold, so you'd be looking at something much brighter, for example.
I think robustness is a big goal, that's a lofty goal.
Yeah.
Do you find that you had to train a certain kind of light and use the same light for testing?
We were doing our training, our training was on the, which, part of the training. So the two parts of the training are sort of separate. The recognition part of the training is separate from the detection part of the training. So the detection part is on black and white and grayscale images.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So for that it wouldn't be as important, but for the detection it's black and white. So, but we were doing it sort of in a fixed environment.
Yeah. Did you guys ever come across the SIFT feature set when you were researching? Like, I think it stands for Scale and Variant Feature Transform. Like, this guy had this picture of a cereal box with a lot of other stuff around it, and then he, like, rotated the box, and it was able to match, like, a point-by-point correspondence between the two. And it, like, had Java code and everything for it. I just remember over the summer finding them.
I don't remember that. But
yeah,
it sounds like it's right.
Might not be another way you could come up with descriptors and then match up those descriptors.
Well, that's sort of what we're doing. We never
came across it. It more depends on the shape. That probably depends on what's actually on the cereal box. Like
I don't know exactly. Maybe they use textures, colors, a lot of other stuff that would be
You know, one of the things that it's, I'm sure there's a whole lot of directions people could take that they could use inside this, but for mouse control or whatever else. But one of the things that kind of strikes me is I've been reading mostly the sci-fi-ish ways, this augmented reality stuff. But if someone is sitting there and this type of system interacted, would people know what augmented reality is? Is
Does anybody not? I mean, we're in a bar, we know. No, but basically, if you watch a football game, which I watch baseball and football, so I'm missing the Yankees right now, but you see the line of scrimmage on TV, they'll have a bright yellow line going across the football field that you see on the TV, but they don't actually see on the field. So basically, this point is dropped on the field where these are. The players actually don't see this line, but you do because of this interpretive stuff. Yelp now has the restaurant review place has an app. Like, it's for iPhone. We can sit there with your camera, look at restaurants on a block, and it actually shows you reviews and names of restaurants as you're viewing with your camera. That's augmented reality. It's all very primitive stages and so on, but I kind of imagine this scenario where, and this is partially based on a sci-fi book, you sit there with these augmented reality glasses that's doing what it's doing, that it's somehow or another it's doing to be doing interpretations of the gestures you're doing. I mean, if it can see this funky interactions with these different areas. That's what you should do in the next project.
This project actually started with like that. Like, George showed me a video of like, I think they made something in MIT with like, they had a camera and it was like finding the book the guy was like looking up. So that's how this started, and somehow led to this. I don't remember how. It's like, that's too far, that's too far.
What can we get an A with?
Yeah. Did you guys ever look at applying your techniques to try to recognize other patterns and other things that are not necessarily from a photograph to say, let's look at raw data and see if we can pattern match in there for
security?
Yeah, like let's see if we can look at this stream of random data and try and find a key. Or let's look at this hard drive without knowing what kind of file systems are on there and try and find patterns in that, and using this sort of pattern matching and transformation idea to try and find sort of abstract things like that.
So like anomalies?
I haven't thought about it. I mean,
a lot of these techniques are really specific to images.
Like, yeah.
I can't really. I did try a neural network at some point. I don't remember for even what, but I remember they
were
for the four realizers. Yeah, that's right. I tried to run them through a neural network. But a lot of these techniques are like very specific, but they work better than the general techniques that so it's.
We really haven't thought about it. We're sort of in this image recognition box. We didn't get out.
It's really just a scale thing. You know, like you're sitting there going, okay, we're going to use American Sign Language with, 28 whatever ancestors of the alphabet. 26, whatever.
Long language, George.
But then you're actually scaling it beyond that, so you can't sit there with a gun stick. You have to sit there with something,
a room.
Large state score. And you're not talking about scale at that point. You're not actually talking about, AI. You're just talking about scale. Am I right? Right, Mark?
I would think so. I mean, I would think that if you... I mean, you have like a fixed point of what you're looking for. You're looking for something and you need a very large database to describe what those things are. And then you're just looking at, you're still looking at random, your points of random data and trying to make sense of it. So,
well,
I mean, there's probably similar techniques, but.
You still need the fingerprint. AI, there's still going to be some kind of template fingerprinting done to actually throw these things in.
It'd be an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely an interesting question to think about if this can sort of be applied. I never thought about it that way. Any other questions? I think we ran over by a lot. I think that's okay. On this stage. Otherwise, if we're presenting at in school, we'd be off. Like, 15 minutes, they kick you off.
You don't even have to be off.
Hi, I'm John Vigo. I'm a senior E at Cooper, and I'm going to be talking about characterizing light output instabilities in quantum cascade lasers. And this was done as a part of an REU program in the summer of 2009 at Princeton University through the Center for Complex Materials. And it was funded by the NSF, and it was part of a joint effort between a few schools, which were Princeton, UMBC, Texas A&M, Johns Hopkins, CCNY, and Rice. And this is a bit of an extension mix of a short presentation I did there, along with a poster session. So, so this is what a quantum cascade laser looks like without all the extra packaging.
It looks like a hand.
Laserized from drawing.
It looks like a mitt. So the picture's not particularly bright because we
didn't I'm actually blind almost, and these glasses don't even fully correct. Let me go up there too. If I can distinguish it. It's a W. I mean,
Okay, so these are the contacts where you apply the voltage, and there's actually this sort of vine, like this little box here, is actually a bunch of lasers because when you make them, you make a bunch of them, and you just connect one to the pads.
How is it this big or is it this big?
The actual size of this thing is probably like this big. So, and that, most of that's not the laser; it's mostly the pads and. The laser is just actually probably, the group of like 10 or so, maybe like 20 lasers that I have to probably about this big. Each laser is less than that, but yeah, I guess it's around 8.
It's really bad.
Yeah, it's a pretty bad picture.
Okay.
It's also in its like little enclosure thing, which, so that we wouldn't like hit it with the camera once or anything, because that would break it and kill it. Okay, so about the organization that does this, their goal, this is a quote from their website, Merck's goal is to develop mid-infrared optical trace gas sensing systems based on new technologies such as quantum cascade lasers or quartz enhanced photoacoustic spectroscopy with the ability to detect minute amounts of chemicals found in the environment or atmosphere emitted from spills, combustion, or natural sources, or exhaled. So I'm going to go a little bit about lasers, but I didn't work in fabrication because it was an 8-week program plus a 1-week presentation, and it requires at least 2 weeks to train you for the clean room and 3 weeks to make a laser that you're going to fail at making. Everyone fails their first time, apparently. So so laser stands for light and amplification by stimulated emission of radiation, and it's essentially an optical amplifier with positive feedback, so it's an oscillator. And there's two things that you need. One is that the gain is greater than the loss, so that you actually get amplification that actually can come out. And your output light comes in phase with the input light. So there's many types. There's gas lasers and semiconductor lasers. Quantum cascade lasers are a type of semiconductor laser. And I'll talk a little bit about standard semiconductor lasers, but I'll completely avoid the topic of gas lasers. So essentially what a laser is, there's two mirrors, an active medium which provides amplification. One of the mirrors, or both of the mirrors, depending on your design, allows a partial transmission, and the output is your laser output. So a conventional semiconductor laser relies on energy level transmissions, and so when it drops energy, you get out a photon. And this is this determines the size of this drop determines what frequency you're getting out. So that's a property of the materials you're using. So if you're using like the telecom equipment, which is indium, gallium arsenide, and InGaAs. So if you're using that, then you'll get a certain frequency. But if you're using another material, you're going to get a different frequency. So, but they're also very cheap. Like most of us have laser pointers at our houses. And they're not tunable, really. Like, if you're going to tune them, you only have, there's like various tricks you have to play with, like the mirrors or which like mode you're selecting in the laser. But the quantum cascade laser addresses some of these issues. So the main thing about quantum cascade lasers is something called band structure engineering. And you can make tunable lasers which can do various wavelengths with the same set of materials. So a lot of the stuff they've been doing, this was originally done in Bell Labs, which in the first half of the 1990s. So they were using the same equipment as the telecom people because they're Bell Labs. You just lay those materials to get your results. And so this is a diagram of the bands. So these are when you were in like modern physics, you did solving Schrodinger's equation with different potentials. So the slant is due to the applied potential. from your voltage source. And then you have these wells, which are used to do optical transitions in the active regions, and the injector regions are doped to provide more electrons, and they just tunnel through. So, and then like little transitions do like vibrate the actual structure, and there's other semiconductor physics involved. So they grow them by essentially growing the crystal themselves, so putting thin layers on top of each layer. And this is a scanning electron microscope photograph of one of the earlier models from one of the earlier designs from like the 1997, I think. So it's replicating each one of these injector region and active region units, and each one of them is 55 nanometers in this particular design. So they're applied again to trace gas sensing. And the reason why they're good for this is because many chemical compounds have modes which are accessible in the mid-infrared region, and that's for the type of quantum cascade lasers that they design because of the material system they use. Because different material systems also do govern to some extent what frequencies and what you can get out. Okay, so now I'm going to get to the topic of instability. So there are quantum cascade lasers that can provide high output power. And what we mean by light output instability is that you get a different amount of light for an identical current impulse, current pulse. So we primarily characterize these by the light, current, and voltage curves. So we're using 5 kilohertz of pulses with 100 nanoseconds width. So this is a setup from one of the last things that I'm going to talk about, but the part that's consistent to all part of all of the tests is that we have a detector, we have optics to focus the laser, and we have a cryostat, which we use to cool the laser. So a diagram of our system is the pulse generator is connected to the cryostat, which has the quantum cascade laser in it. And the cryostat is attached to liquid nitrogen. So we did all these tests of 80 degrees Kelvin so that you don't have thermal effects. And also the particular lasers we had were designed for room temperature operation. That's connected to a temperature controller, which is essentially a PID controller. And the output of the quantum cascade lasers redirected the optics, which are sent to the detector, and we use an oscilloscope, which is essentially a computer that can, at this point, like oscilloscopes are essentially computers, that you can just sample the outputs, the actual powers of that you get from the detector. So this is what a curve looks like. So there's a time, for a while the laser doesn't turn on, and then afterwards, as you increase the current, you get an increase in light output power. So this is a current, this is an LI curve actually. And the little chart is summing on the residuals of the fit to it, which will come back later. Okay, so we also did some time series analysis, which is when we got instabilities, we took a long series of measurements at a fixed current value, and then we asked ourselves a few questions. Is it stationary? Is it a linear process? So you use techniques based on the autocorrelation. We asked ourselves if it was chaotic, because optical feedbacks have been known to cause chaos. So we used the one thing that was fairly easy to quantify, because we were able to easily find algorithms there to detect this, called Lyapunov exponents, and we tried to use a fairly standard model in engineering called, an extension of a fairly standard model in engineering of ARMA models called ARIMA models. So ARIMA models stand for autoregressive integrated moving averages, and moving average models are weighted sum of current and prior inputs, autoregressive, you work on the outputs, and ARMA is when you have both autoregressive and moving average terms. And when you're modeling it, you usually have to make a stationarity assumption, but data isn't often stationary. So if you take differences of adjacent samples, it decorrelates them, and it also makes the data more stationary. And you have to be careful when you're doing this, because if you do it too many times, you just lose your data. And if the difference data fits an ARMA model, then the original data fits an ARIMA model. And you could repeat this many times, so you could have like an ARIMA model, but after, like, based on like various books you look into, doing it more than two times or three times is essentially asking to ruin your data. Okay, so These are autocorrelation function plots, so I guess since you probably can't see them, I'll trace them. So this one goes like this. This one goes like this, and then it's zero, and this one's just one, that thing. So the left is an example of what the autocorrelation looks like when you're dealing with something non-stationary. And then after taking one difference, we got this, which if you look in a time series book, it'll tell you that it looks like a moving one first order moving average. And the right, when you just have one thing, is white noise. And this is from one laser that we tested that exhibited this kind of behavior. And it's not true of all the lasers, but based on what we've been told by the grad student we were working with, that this usually happens with the higher power lasers. So we looked at deterministic chaos, and you can see this in sufficiently high order ODEs and recurrence maps. We have discrete observations, and it can all can look similar to probabilistic phenomena. So one example that a famous author gives in his book is that a student built a system that was used to play a Mariah Carey song, but you weren't supposed to know that it was a Mariah Carey song. So on one end, he had the focus circuit and he fed in the Mariah Carey song. And when you're listening to it, you think, oh, it's white noise, because we've all heard white noise on like our telephones or somewhere.
Mariah Carey.
Alright, so, but then at the other end, he had this receiver circuit. And by tuning the parameters to match with the original circuit, he was able to strip out to recover the thing, and it sounded like Mariah Carey. Though people apparently said that Mariah Carey sounds like white noise, as you just said. So there's one way of quantifying chaos is the way that Lyapunov exponents assume is that if you have two arbitrarily close states, they'll diverge at an exponential rate. And the reason why we looked at this type is that it's easy to estimate. And one paper that's widely cited for this is has something called Wolf's algorithm. Well, he doesn't call it Wolf's algorithm, but a lot of other people do. And so there's been modifications to improve stability on it. So, and it's already pre-written, which takes away a lot of the issues in dealing with numerics. And we use the open source Tysian package from a school in Germany to estimate these. So we found that if it's positive, that it indicates that there's a possibility of chaotic behavior. And some of our series did have that. And we did have some indications of nonlinear behavior. Okay, so another thing is that we looked at were different modes of a laser, and this essentially deals with the electromagnetic properties of something called waveguides. A waveguide allows certain modes of light or EMM radiation to propagate. So the most common ones that you see in an introductory electromagnetics class is the TE, TM, and TEM modes. And T stands for transverse to the direction of propagation. And it was we suspected that the lasers might be supporting multiple modes. And this is not necessarily a bad thing, because if you have multiple modes, you get to put out higher powers. But it would also, if this were true, it would also explain why our readings were happening this way. So this is an example from a visible light laser that I got from the book. And this is what most people consider like an ideal beam for like their applications. Its intensity is Gaussian, and it's really symmetric and easy to focus. It's really tiny. And then this is the TM11 mode, which has four beams, and it doesn't have the same nice symmetry. And what could have happened was that your detector wasn't consistently seeing everything or something. And also, since these are mid-infrared lasers, you can't actually see them when you're aligning them. So what we did was we partially blocked the beam and took measurements at different levels of blocking. And then since we were measuring power and we wanted intensity, we took derivative. And if you get one peak, it indicates that there's one transverse mode in the laser. Due to the large amount of time to get each curve, which was probably around 15 minutes, and we were able to share the lab with other people, we essentially did not, we only used roughly around 10 or 11 blockings. So The profiles we got for one particular model are shown here. They look like they have one peak, but without doing more blocking, we can't actually definitively conclude that. So it would need to be sampled at a much higher, much smaller distance. So our conclusions were that the instabilities in quantum cascade lasers, we essentially investigated the instabilities of quantum cascade lasers experimentally. We didn't work from the solid state physics approach to show that the different like models of the quantum cascade laser that were given in literature since like the 1970s would produce this. We did our EMA modeling. We said that there's a possibility of chaos. And our experimentation for beams showed that there was most likely a single mode of the lasers. And I'd like to thank my advisor, Professor Clara Gamacho at Princeton, my partner, Brian Edwards, who was a math undergrad at Princeton, Peter Liu, who was a Princeton E graduate student, the NSF for funding, Mert for hosting me, and the Princeton Center for Complex Materials for also hosting me. Questions?
It's very technical.
Yep.
Alright, so if I understand this, you were saying earlier that up to a certain point, you were able to continue your modulation, and beyond that, you went into chaos. So is that level adjustable?
So we essentially had. So the way that we did our experiments, we were given like six lasers that were three of each design, and so essentially, like once you had like one laser, it was essentially consistent within that one, and we couldn't like actually modify it. So lasers can change from the heating and cooling cycle that you need to do this, because you have to bring it up 100 degrees Kelvin to like actually like align, like set it up in the cryostat, and then you have to bring it down to 80 Kelvin. So that like thermal effects could have happened or something. So we had two designs, so we couldn't actually, we weren't able to actually modify the lasers to deal with that. Does that answer your question? Yep.
There's the old theory of the laser. They always mentioned Einstein's code. Now, what is the quantum? If there's a short explanation, what's a quantum cascade laser as distinguished from an old-fashioned gas laser?
Can I answer this from a semiconductor perspective?
Sure. What's that?
Can I answer this with a semiconductor laser?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So, all right. Let me go back to the purpose.
What's the difference?
I don't know
what a quantum cascade laser is. Once upon a time. I knew what a laser was.
Okay, so when you have one photon come out of when you make one photon in a regular laser,
right.
you only get one more photon out.
Okay.
So because when you get a stimulated emission, you get one photon giving you two photons.
Yes.
So in this, you send one photon in this way,
right.
And then you get one transition here, so that gives you one more photon. In an active region,
uh-huh.
And then so now you have two photons. The
right.
Two photons go in; they tunnel through here. They go into the next active region. You get four photons,
okay.
And so on.
Okay.
So you like the old ones that like they had in the 90s. You'd get like for every like one photon or something, you'd get something like 80 photons that,
right.
Like gain.
Understood.
So
okay,
so multiply.
So gaining per
photon
gas point or length or something, some characteristic thing is higher.
Yeah, they essentially produce more photons for every photon I'm putting in.
Now that based on a physical structure?
Yeah, actually these okay. So the tiltingness is due to you're applying an electric field, which is creates potential. But the actual structure is dependent on the width of these bands. So you have two different materials. Like I don't know, this isn't the exact same structure that's used here.
Sure.
But you can actually see that there's different layers. And those layers do actually correspond directly to which bands you're making here.
Okay.
So it is a physical structure when you turn your head to the right or left.
Alright.
Anything else? Okay. Thanks again.
Wait, I got one more question.
All right.
Where is FreeBSD used in this?
Where is
FreeBSD?
Yeah, I'll be there.
No, no, it's okay.
It was made at LS, usually.
Okay, so evening everyone. My name is Kevin Kien. This is my partner with Cornwall Esperance. And for our natural language processing course last semester, we did a study of Bayesian authorship attribution. So authorship attribution is actually a very, our talk actually isn't very technical, so it'll maybe be a little bit more accessible to the general audience. But the idea of authorship attribution, I mean, it's just what it sounds like. Imagine on your BSD mailing list, right, someone posted anonymously, and you think, wait, I mean, this writing style seems sort of familiar. Is there any way we can sort of tell quantitatively who might have written this post? Well, if you have all of your past mailing list archives with known authors, you know, that would be a database you draw from. And we decided to explore different ways of how we might quantitatively determine who that author might have been. So we rely heavily on Bayesian techniques here, which is they're a category of statistical type techniques. And like George and Eugene's project, we basically have a training set with pieces of writing from known authors, and we try to predict pieces of writing from unknown authors. So the methods that we explored involve function word usage, sentence structure, n-grams, and word counts. These things we'll go more in depth into later in the presentation. We used two corpora to test on. One of them was a corpora of novels, novels by Jane Austen and Emily Bronte, and one of them was a corpora of technical writing drawn from professors at the Cooper Union. So our system was evaluated using cross-validation, and we used everything that you will be seeing here, with the exception of one thing, is done in Perl. So if any of you are Perl hackers, we use Perl for this. We like Perl.
Okay, so to talk a little bit about the corpora we used, our main corpus was the Austen and Bronte corpus, and that consisted of, I think, three novels from Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte. And the reason why we chose these two authors is because we really wanted to test our system. I mean, we could have used two authors whose writing styles are obviously different, like, you know, Vonnegut and Shakespeare, but we wanted to eliminate factors such as time period, social background, gender, and subject matter. So we chose two female authors who lived around the same time and who, you know, wrote about similar things. Okay, and the other corpus, labeled the Cooper corpus, was used to kind of test the robustness of our system. This was we just basically emailed a bunch of professors and were like, okay, can you just send us some examples of your writing? So some of them are just like LaTeX formatted documents. I mean, these have lots of typographical errors, and some professors only sent us, you know, a couple paragraphs. So basically,
what's that a picture of in the lower right?
That is the Cooper Union Foundation building.
Oh, of course. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
But that's really nothing to do with this. All right. So it's a relatively small amount of data compared with like the three novels, which were in fairly good typographical shape because they were all plain text from Project Gutenberg, which is another reason why we chose Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte, because a lot of works were available for free. All right, so we tested on documents that varied from 20 sentence extracts to 100 sentences. And these were we took one of the remaining novels that we didn't train on, and we kind of pulled random sentences from it, so they weren't like a continuous paragraph in the novel. We actually took sentences from different locations in the novel to test on. And I mean, this is just an example of, this is the Cooper corpus with various professors' names and the number of sentences we used to test on.
Did you do any control on that specific area, just because of there's going to be a difference between what you're going to get with a conversation, a discussion going on in the book versus, right?
Well, I mean, a lot of the point, right, of authorship attribution is that the system should be invariant to whatever you're talking about. So ideally, you'd hope that a conversation in the book, it would just still somehow reflect the author enough so that it would be, you know, your system can still recognize it.
Okay. So as Kevin mentioned before, we use the naive Bayes assumption when we analyze this data. So basically, the assumption is that the probability of a token only appearing in the document only depends on the fact that it's from that specific author, which that's obviously untrue. I mean, we're going to talk a little bit more about what tokens we actually use, but like a token can just be a word, it can be categorizing a phrase as like a noun phrase or a verb phrase, etc. And obviously there's a lot of patterns in the English language which already dictate these sorts of patterns. So the probability of seeing like a verb phrase after a noun phrase, I mean that's based on the phrase before it, not only the fact that it's from this particular author's work. So this assumption obviously isn't completely correct, but we're going to use it anyway because it makes it easy to train on data and extract sort of these probabilities which we'll see up here. And we also used n-grams to improve on the naive assumption, and we'll show how we actually implemented that. But this equation here basically shows how we estimated which category we think the test document, which author we think that test document is written by. And so basically, you loop through all of the tokens in the document, and you have this table of probabilities from the training set. And you say, okay, so how many times has this token appeared in this author's training set over the term of one year? Tokens, and that's this probability here. And you basically multiply the stream of probabilities, but in this case, we're using log probabilities, since the probability of, you know, a document given an author is very, very small. So we're using log probabilities, which means you add them together. And then you also add the probability of a particular category or author, but we didn't really use this because we tried to train on an equal amount of text from both authors. Because it's not like we're sitting there and, you know, there's like a 70% chance of getting Jane Austen's work and a 30%. Like, that's not really what we're trying to, that's really not our situation. We're just trying to estimate who wrote the document.
That's the speed daters.
Okay, so one of the tokens we used were the categorizations of phrases. So we used the Sundance system, which was developed at the University of Utah. It's basically a parser that we could invoke, and you'll see the output of the parser in the next slide. But basically, it goes through the entire document and breaks it up into, okay, this is a noun phrase, verb phrase, prepositional phrase, or adjective phrase. So our tokens were, you know, each clause would be broken up into a string of these letters. And I think in the actual implementation, these things match only like one letter when we actually stored it in the hash tables. So you have strings of N, P, B, and A, and they would all, when you're going through your training data, those would all get put into a hash table, and each entry in the hash would have an array with the number of elements corresponding to the number of authors. So usually it was, for the Austin Bronte corpus, it was two, but for the Cooper corpus, it was like 6%. So this is an example of what the parser outputs. So, you know, actually this parser was really nice because even if it didn't recognize a word, like this is the British spelling of the word specter, so it didn't know what it was, but it still correctly grouped it in the noun phrase segment, so it's good at inferring, even if it doesn't know what a word means, how it should categorize the phrase. And so then we had to go through and basically kind of analyze, we wrote like a proscript to go through this and then pick out these indicators. Okay, and then, so n-grams, we tried to improve on the naive assumption by seeing if we could exploit patterns in the author's writings dealing with, okay, maybe this author likes to use prepositional phrases after verb phrases more than this other author. So this is basically the goal of using n-grams. So in the hash table, instead of just having these strings of letters that are on like a per clause basis, we actually are also storing, you know, what's the probability of seeing this token given the previous 1, 2, or 3, however large n is, however many, whatever the order of your n-gram is. And this is estimated according to this equation. So if you had a string like A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and you wanted to do the trigram probability for, you know, the letter D, you would say, this would be, okay, what's the probability, how many times have I seen B, C, D, over how many times have I just seen B, and C. And that's how we estimate those probabilities. Okay, here's some results. So the main thing to take away from this is that the bigrams, trigrams, and up to 6 grams work a lot better than just looking at the clauses themselves. And for 100 sentences, the system did fairly well. It got 95% accuracy, and it expectedly kind of steadily increased up to that point, because obviously if it has more sentences, it will give a better estimation. And then this is the other corpus, the Cooper corpus. And we don't know exactly why, when it went up to 5 grams and 6 grams, it did so bad. Maybe because some sentences didn't have like 6 tokens in them, and our system didn't handle that. But for whatever reasons, these results were less what we would have predicted.
Okay, so all these features that we sort of observed, they're the features that Nicole was talking about, they're what's called more deeper linguistic features. Right? So you're talking about, you know, things like the actual, how to happen with the parsing, the parts of speech and whatnot. So another thing we decided to look at were function words. So really, when you write, we can divide the words you write down into maybe 2 categories, right? One category has words with lots of semantic meaning. So words like, you know, baseball, bat, BSD. These things have meaning in them. You need them in there to make the sentence have some sort of sense. But other words like VA and of, or these really short, tiny words, they're only there usually for grammatical purposes. They don't have any, they're empty of semantic meaning. So the function words are actually one of the most popular ways that authorship classification is implemented in production, right? It's very accurate. There's actually an example of the Federalist Papers from the American Revolution, that time period. There was a number of unauthored ones, or one anonymously written ones. And so, one of the first people, one of the first groups to try and do this authorship classification thing, they actually worked on that training set, and they came up with 89% probabilities that the author of one of the papers was either Madison. Yeah. So, and they did that purely based on function words. So we decided to try and see if we can see what kind of results we got using function words. One little tweak we did was that we mapped all the pronouns to one token, so like all the pronouns of one specific part of speech. So he, she, it, all the subject pronouns we mapped to a generic one, because again, I want to emphasize here that we want the classification system to be completely, as much as we can, independent of the content. Right? Just because someone's writing a sport, someone is like a movie reviewer, doesn't mean that every movie review is written by him. So we wanted to try and blank out the content as much as possible. So these are the results if you just use function words. Now, there's actually an interesting thing here going on. What happens is that in the naive Bayes sort of way of looking at things, if you have a word that did not appear in your training set, but that does appear in your testing set, well, what do you do with that? It had a 0 probability in the original set.
Impossible.
It would be impossible.
It's impossible according to Bayes' theorem.
It's
impossible that it could not appear.
That it could not. Yeah, right, exactly. That's the problem. It's impossible.
Made a mistake. You have to throw out that thing.
Exactly. So, this is a very wide field of study, but what do you do with those impossibilities? I mean, not only is it impossible, if you try to take the log of 0, I mean, our computer would blow up, right?
That's right. Very dangerous.
Right, very dangerous. So the simplest
way to put the trap on.
The simplest way to deal with this is to simply say, wait, no, it did appear in our training set, but just once.
So, like the other kind of statisticians, the classical ones, you also lie.
It works reasonably for general uses of these of applications of Bayesian classification systems. But for us, things didn't work out so nicely. These two in the bottom that you see down here, around 50-60% accuracy, these are what happens when you only use that. It's called plus add one smoothing. So what we did was, we tweaked the smoothing a little bit. Instead of saying, well, let's pretend that it did appear in our training set, let's just sort of not think about it at all. Let's just pretend that it didn't appear anywhere, because, well, what we thought was, if this word that the author used didn't appear in the original training set for that author, maybe there's a reason there. Maybe that guy just doesn't like using the word of. Right. So we thought that, well, this might actually help us out.
And that's statistically important. I mean, that's usually important.
Right, yeah. So the results we get if we apply this sort of heuristic tweak is in the 90s, and up there at 100 sentences in our test documents, we actually achieved 100% accuracy on our test set.
What?
100% accuracy.
That's because these words are always the author's name, right?
So for the Cooper corpus, same sort of results. If you use the original type of smoothing, you get these lousy, 10-20% results. However, you get 90%+ results if we use this modified smoothing method. Another sort of linguistic feature we decided to look at was your sentence length. So maybe some people like using longer sentences than other people. Really simple, easy thing to measure, quantify in a document. But we figured, well, maybe this one might actually help us. So these are results for a Bayesian classification system that uses sentence length, average sentence lengths of authors, and we get between 60-70%, which, I mean, it's not stellar, but it's better than guessing. For the Cooper corpus, again, this is the smoothing difference here. If we use add one smoothing, we get accuracies in the 20% or so. If we use modified smoothing methods, it jumps up by 30%. So, I mean, suffice to say, smoothing is a really big thing here. Now, the last thing that we decided to do was think, well, maybe, since all these different features we looked at by themselves seem to be able to give us some clues and insight into the author, what if we just combined them all in a really stupid way to see if this combination would give us even more insight? So what we did was, we just mashed them all together into one big token list. So let's say your token list might have words like and or of and how many times they appeared. They'd also have numbers like 5 or 6 for a sentence with 5 words in it, a sentence with 6 words in it, so on and so forth. Because of time constraints, we were only able to combine function words and sentence length. And if you go to the results, what we did was, so here, you can see that for 80, 90, and 100 sentences in a document on the Austin Bronte corpus, we actually get 100% accuracy. But only after applying this another here, sort of really heuristic tweak. We just looked at it, thought maybe this will work. The idea was that sentence length for the Austin Bronte corpus was an okay indicator, 60-70%. Maybe they shouldn't be weighted as heavily as the function words in our token list. So we multiplied all their counts by, I believe it was 0.8 to cut them down. Really, it was fairly arbitrary, but it improved our results, so anyone can say. In the Cooper corpus, we did the same sort of thing, except instead of multiplying by 0.8, we only multiplied by 0.5, because for the Cooper corpus, sentence weight was an even worse measure of the authorship. And still, with this modification, we were also again able to achieve 100% accuracy at longer document lengths.
Okay. So we discovered that relatively simple techniques such as the function words and sentence length, they yield high accuracy. But I think we probably needed to do more research into the effects of smoothing and what that had on our system instead of just kind of picking something arbitrary. But, it worked, it fixed everything, so we just kind of left it that way. We don't really have a clear understanding or mathematical basis to explain why exactly that worked. And then another thing we wanted to do was combine all of the features, including the deeper linguistic features, which did fairly well for what they are, basically a string of letters that, you know, say noun phrase, verb phrase, adjective phrase. Yeah, so we definitely want to try, we would want to try combining all of those into another testing system. And we would like to thank all the professors who contributed to our corpus and to Alan Riloff, who created the Sundance parser, which is very easy.
What's the licensing on the Sundance?
We actually emailed her and she just said we could use it whatever.
Oh, that's good.
It's under development there, and we just sort of it happened upon one of their webpages about it, and it looked like it fit our goals.
What was really striking to me? What was really striking to me right away, as soon as I started hearing what you guys are talking about, was that it reminds me of so many of the basic script analysis concepts. So frequency analysis, right? In English, the most common, you know, the bigger the body of the corpus you're working off of, the more likely that E is going to be 11.2% of the letters.
Right.
And then E, T, A, whatever, you know. And that's what was really funny. I don't know if you guys are familiar at all with it, essentially, but also you're just expanding it. So if someone's code breaking, right? You're code breaking, you know, pre-Enigma, you know, going back way back when, it would sit there and the function words is actually would usually reveal the substitution patterns that took place. So if it was a one letter word in there, they knew right away that was gonna in the English language would be an A.
Yeah.
So you go, okay, well if this means an A, it's just a simple substitution, boom, boom, boom. I just got all the A's in here like that because someone left one letter out. Or there was a date on top. You know, and it was, you know, the old European style, the number, month, year, or whatever it is, or however they organize it. So it right away revealed so many things about the pattern and so on. Obviously, you guys have another whole other angle, but that's what's really striking to me about, you know, from frequency analysis, which came out of like the 14th century in the Islamic Empire or whatever, but that whole concept is just striking. Line of type machines, when I was your age, newspapers were set up on line of type machines.
Still going on in the early 90s.
Right. And what would happen is they had done the 1 gram analysis with a gram with a character. And if the machine was idling and it made a mistake, it shot out the type E, T, A, O, I, and space. Shrigaloo. And so at the end of the newspaper article, there would have often appeared, and twine shrigaloo, it was bumping like that.
Yes, sir.
So, do you plan to turn all of these results to the English teacher so that you can check all the papers in the
chat? I mean, in trouble, this would be, there would be an excellent application for the system that we developed.
Or an R1. I think such things are already available.
Yes.
Have you ever tried to use this looking at more technical information in that sort of sense to say, be kind of an interesting thing, but let's look at the corpus of all of the source code for, let's say, the Linux kernel versus the NetBSD kernel. Let's see. Who stole what? You know, I think it might be an interesting thing just to try and determine who wrote what. Mm-hmm. You know, because sometimes you look at these things and it gets lost for whatever reason. You don't know why it's there. Commit logs get screwed up, things like that. It could be an interesting application just to be able to place blame better.
The idea is that we wanted to, like a parser would definitely have to be different, but the idea is we wanted to make this as domain independent as possible, which is usually an incredibly difficult task, right? Usually classification systems are set up for, you know, things like views, for example, like these categories, right? It's all very specific, and you can tweak them. And like the old adage in like the analytics community is that it's really easy to get something to like 90% accuracy, but then 5 years later, you're maybe at 92%. So
first thing is, if you guys consider testing really large data sets, and doing classification on that. So, like, I understand the Cooper corpus was like you have like 10 or 12 professors. How about if you have like doing, like, what if you had, I don't know, somebody else in during that time period that also had a couple of novels so that you could try classification again? Then, do you think the results would change?
Hopefully not. No, it, like the Cooper corpus, like you said, I guess it was the it was the proof of concept that this could be extended to and different databases. And in fact, I would expect it to work better because we have more things.
More data.
Yeah, some of the professors, we just had like their thesis or something, or their technical papers, and like their theses, we had to copy and paste PDF code, and so when it came back down, a lot of stuff was completely garbled. We think that was one of the reasons we got like really horrible results sometimes, because
we didn't write the parser, we don't know how it handles unknown character symbols.
Yeah, we tried to go through and remove like, you know, the backslash entry and stuff like that, but I guess, you know, once again, it's hard to avoid. But we think we could get pretty good results if we had three.
What about non-English languages? Have you experimented with any non-English?
We have not.
Yeah, it's completely dependent on the parser there, which is you guys.
Also, yeah, would change, the patterns will change.
Yeah, like the which words would be considered functional words? I would imagine for most of isolated type languages like English, right? You would be able to apply much the same techniques given that you had the right parser. However, for more agglutinative languages that tend to grab a lot of meaning into one, like Bulgarian, for instance, where like one morpheme can tell you, oh, this is third person past, you know, something like that. And opposed to English, where such things are a lot simpler. Like, so I, for those kinds of languages, like with Chinese or Japanese, I would expect it to, our task to be a lot more difficult than our results to not be as good.
But I think the parser would be much more difficult.
When you wonder what the variety happens between these individual languages too, mm-hmm. The more analytic languages, since the order in which words can appear kind of dictates the structure more.
Right. So subject, object, verb, subject, verb, object.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be different. I mean, you think of French is very, very standardized. I mean, Napoleon, you know, the Academy of France says, gives some two rules and nationally how French would be spoken. So, you know,
that doesn't mean it's followed.
But not a formal question, of course, the old being the same thing, but you're not supposed to say that in French. The idea is that there's a strict structure in order to try to unite the dialects. English obviously is another story. But what's really screwy are other languages, like in Italian, the possessive can come before and after, depending on how you're emphasizing something.
Sure.
It really is no, it's all very much, so that's where it would get messy. German, in some ways, would be the easiest and the hardest, right? Sometimes they get the vertical or in the sentence.
Well, these affect these definitely affect the deep linguistic features a lot more than the shallow ones. So you might be able to still get away with a sentence length and if applicable to function words, but you have to completely relook at that whether or not the n-gram models are still applicable to such as.
Well, then maybe they can even be better if there's more variation or more freedom in the language, so it could vary more on a per author basis.
Do you think the Cooper corpus was slightly skewed because of just incorrect grammar? Just run-on sentences? You know?
Well, there wouldn't be, the type of documents, just like as a point of information, the types of documents we pulled were someone's submission to a math journal, professor's thesis paper, one of the professor's work towards his PhD, one of them is an actually humanities professor, so I would hope that one doesn't have many run-on sentences, right? But absolutely that would affect the especially the action of the parser, right?
Yeah.
So
would you be
able to somehow have, if you had an unknown group of authors just to pile documents,
yeah,
I think you'd be able to like separate them to be like, okay, this group is probably George Washington. This is probably
As long as we had enough samples of actual writing from George Washington. However, we could probably try something like given a set of documents from like five authors, it might be possible to say to divide them into groups of five, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
Not necessarily given the training set, but we wouldn't be able to carry out any further identification unless we had a training set.
It would be harder with the Federalist Papers, but it's the same era, same type of background education, and so on.
Right.
You know, from a certain small layer of people in the 13 colonies versus, we're going to compare, like, you know, Hegel to George Bush to, you know,
Well, they had two candidates for the authors for the Federalist Papers. So they were only comparing between Madison and Hamilton. Yeah, they had lots of samples of their work.
Right, right. Well, they had one they didn't know, and they had the rest of the pattern there. And we said, okay, where is this one today?
Yeah.
That's easy. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I talked to this listener, and he said that sample
of we shifted from, I believe, 20 sentences in one document that we tried to identify up to 100 sentences per document. So you're basically looking, where did these 20 sentences come from? Where did these 30 sentences come from so far, and so on and so forth?
And for every point going back to practice, the training data was always the same
one? The training data was always the same, because it doesn't matter what length the training data is. All that we look at is at the very end of the day, what probabilities we have accumulated through all the sentences. So the training length is invariant.
One document for all of the training?
It'll be,
I think we use two novels.
It'll be the rest of everything else. So we divided like one novel per author. For the Austin Bronte one, we took one novel per author and randomized the sentences and picked out groups of 20, then groups of 30, then groups of 40. And the training set was the other two novels, everything in the other two novels.
Sir?
One of the Bronte sisters wrote a wonderful review of Jane Austen. Work. I recommend it. It's not a question.
Do you ever think of that as an interesting point, comparing family members? You know, like, two
we
corpses
were,
of work.
Yeah, going to do the Bronte sisters, but Emily Bronte only has one.
I couldn't think of it, like, for them, I don't think it would work, but I know there's probably more modern authors that have, you know, another sibling who wrote enough work wouldn't be
the problem with modern texts is that they weren't available for free.
There's a lot on Gutenberg. I mean, it would be kind of interesting. I know there's a lot of like technical stuff out there you could probably do. Yeah. I think it would be interesting to see because, you know, two family members may go to the same school, they may speak the same way, they may even write the same way. Right. I think that would be a really good test to see how well the system really works, given two very, very similar sets of data.
Yeah, you can sit there and just do hold on as a test run, you know, like, siblings in the same region, the same era, where dialects were very, very important in language, right?
Twins.
Twins of the same sex, twins of the opposite.
Yeah.
But you know, demand pages would be really fun. I'm not thinking of code, we have demand pages.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you very much.